Thundergrunt.
What's up?
Bob.
Introduce yourselves.
Who are you, Bob?
Oh, I'm Bob Rose. I'm a Baltimore filmmaker and an editor and a man.
I am Jimmy George. I am a script consultant and a screenwriter.
I am Jamie Nash, writer of screens, both large and small.
That's right.
All sizes. All sizes. All devices, Jamie Nash. Today we're going to talk about It. We're going to say Stephen King's It every single time.
You have to.
Avoid any confusion. We're going to talk about the new It, not the TV movie. Andy Muschietti's It.
Good.
I don't know if I'm saying that right. We had some confusion on that.
I think it's pronounced Andy.
Andy Muschietti. I don't know how to say his name. But we're going to talk about what is the highest grossing horror movie of all time.
I think it might be. I didn't check.
With inflation.
Google.
With inflation. I'm asking. I don't know.
Well, the extra,
Bride of Chucky might be.
Dude, I'd be so about that.
Yeah, no, it's... it was
pirated.
Right.
It was It, and then The Sixth Sense, and then War of the Worlds.
Does War of the Worlds
three.
Count as a horror movie?
Or Sixth Sense, for that matter.
Yeah, both of them are on the line.
Sixth Sense
or
more there.
It, for that matter.
I mean, I got this off the IMDb horror movie list, so we'll see.
Was that made by a fan, or was it made by IMDb?
No, made by IMDb. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. I would bet the Scream movies
were up there.
By
Amazon, like everything else?
I bet the Scream movies were up there, too.
Oh, gotta be, yeah.
They must be up there.
I feel like they would be. They'd have
but it's
to
something
be.
Like,
at least one.
Did it make over a billion? Close.
I didn't look it up.
Damn it, Jamie, fuck.
Everyone.
It's on the outline, everyone. I brought it up because I thought he looked it up.
I mean, this is, knowing the box office numbers is very instructive. You know, people at home.
The name is Writers Blockbusters. Yeah. This, Jamie, you don't need to look it up. This was a blockbuster through and
Absolutely.
Through. This was a mega hit of the summer.
Yeah.
Everyone was talking about it.
And it was kind of rare for horror.
And rated R.
Yeah,
both
it was
of
kind
those
of,
things.
It's kind of like a blockbuster horror movie. I mean, it was a big event.
Absolutely.
You know? Which is rare. I mean, what was the last horror movie you can think of that was kind of like an event, like a summer blockbuster? I know this wasn't summer, but that kind of movie. Can you think of any?
Not like this. Not that everyone.
Not
was
that.
Talking
not
about.
That. Where the anticipation was on this level.
Yeah.
Like, because you know, there's so much history here with the franchise.
Yeah.
And the source material, and then the original movie with Tim Curry and everything.
Yeah. Oh my God.
This has so much lineage to build up.
Plus all the years of them trying to get it into motion. You know, I mean, you were hearing for years the It, remake is in development. Which saying remake is weird.
It's not a remake. It's remade from the source material.
Right, yeah.
There
yeah.
is nods to the original movie in it. We're not gonna.
Yeah,
touch on that, but it's not a remake per se.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like how Charlie and the Chocolate Factory isn't a remake of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Exactly.
It's like the source material.
I thought you were
going to
go Charlie's Angels.
Jamie always brings up Charlie's Angels.
Jamie
like
loves Charlie's
comedy.
Angels.
Yes.
Let the man love it.
That's
awesome.
I just like the Beyonce song. That's the best part.
That's the only thing you like.
Yeah, I've never seen the movie. Actually. By the way,
Crispin Glover's best role.
Yes.
No.
I looked up the box office.
What is it?
It's
what is
in
it?
The 700 million-y range.
It didn't make
combined.
But for a horror movie,
that's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah, usually what happens.
If it was solo, it would suck. But for a horror movie, it's positive.
What's the budget on It?
Oh, now I got to go back and look up the budget. What is this?
It's okay. It's our 11th episode. We can still be bad at this, right?
The budget was $35 million bucks.
See, for $700 million on $35 million, that's an amazing success for a horror movie.
Yeah, and I mean we were talking about the development of it. So it first had, well, it actually had a screenwriter that, again, I can't remember because I didn't bring up Wikipedia or something on it for many years. But then the True Detective team came in. Well, I can never pronounce the guy's name. Kerry
Fukunaga. We apologize if that's
sorry, Kerry, if you're listening.
Sorry,
you're talented. We're sorry about your name.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he was brought in, and there was a lot of excitement because, you know, he had that kind of Lovecraftian vibe going for True Detective, and he worked on it for some time. But then they came to creative differences, and he left the project, and the director of Mama. Who is another name? Everybody's name is really hard
to pronounce.
You mean the director of this? Andy. It looks to me like it's Andy Muschietti.
Yeah, I want to call him Andy Muschietti.
Andy Muschietti. It looks like Italian to me, but I don't know. I'd have to look it up. It looks like Muschietti. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it works.
Yeah. So he came in after the True Detective team left. I think, but I looked at both of their drafts. I did a quick browsing of this a long time ago, back when the movie came out. And the True Detective draft, we'll call it, was very similar to this draft. Like, they had made the decision to do, the two movies split into two the exact same way.
Which I think is a really smart decision.
A lot of the decisions were the same. There were some key detail differences. There were
smart
some scenes
business
extended.
Decision. Not just a smart writing decision, the business decision of the two was...
Yeah, well, you
amazing.
They, I'm shocked they didn't try to make it into a trilogy and do like the Hobbit thing where they stretch the material and add stuff.
There's still a time on the.
I know. But
we're gonna hear part two's three.
I appreciated that they were like, no, we're just gonna do the children's version and then the adult. You know, I think that's a perfect way to cut this into two. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think in the wrong hands. They would have made it three.
Made it one, maybe. Is there too much story for maybe 90 minutes?
Yeah. I will say,
1,100 pages.
Having read the book decades ago, when I was a little kid, I read this book. I mean, I was.
Have
probably,
we all read the book? I've read it.
I was probably 10 when I read it, or 11 or something. I don't know. It was really young.
Man, that's a weird read for an 11-year-old.
It's all I used to read was Stephen King books.
What do you think of the sex scene when you?
I probably loved it. I was probably looking forward to something like that happening in my own life, which never happened.
You're always in the sewer running around.
Yeah, I was in the sewer playing.
No, I actually did play in the sewers.
I did too.
Thinking of it now, I'm like that kid who fears the gray water. I'm like, gray water.
Yeah. No, we totally played in the sewers. But having read that book, I always wondered how that second part is going to translate, not really remembering the miniseries. Because as I remember the book, it was almost powered. The adult story is almost powered by the mystery of not knowing what it is, not knowing all the details, not knowing what happened. And it's kind of a flimsy story taken. If you just take out the adult story by itself and put it on paper, it's kind of flimsy.
Oh, okay.
It's really powered by that mystery of, we don't know what it is. Why is this person committing suicide? Why are they calling each other back? Why are they going back to Derry?
Maybe J.J. Abrams should have directed the second one for the mystery box.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
And without the mystery, I'm curious. I think the true adaptation work, the really hard adaptation, is in the second story. The first, you could almost take it and fix the problems and work the logic out and do some of the stuff that makes it more cinematic. But I think that second thing, that second story, is really going to have to be worked on and figured out.
You're saying you think this was the easier home run?
I do. Okay. And I don't remember the miniseries well enough to remember how they made these choices. But
I think a lot of it had to do with a loss of memory. A lot of them don't remember.
The miniseries also is concurrently cutting back and forth.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not completely separating it.
For some reason, I thought it was also separated like this.
No, it's just really long. Okay. And they do cut back and forth, though.
It's been a while.
I haven't actually sat through the miniseries in maybe 5-6 years, but I remember it cuts back and forth, whereas this is literally just cutting them in half. Yeah. You know, there's not any concurrent storytelling going on.
Yeah.
Like, the book's like that, though, right? The book, I remember. It's been a long time.
No,
for
the
me.
Book goes, it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Right.
But that's what I'm saying. The back and forth, there's a big mystery in the adult side because they don't have their memory. You don't know what they did. That's where a lot of the tension comes from.
They're kind of removing the puzzle of this.
Yeah, it's
by their handling of the first
the way they're doing
the
it.
Movie.
But I guess they figure it's been done like the source material and the original movie did that, so they're trying something
different.
Like, it's kind of like Lost, the later seasons of Lost, spoiler, where they flashed forward when they were off the island, but then they were still on the island.
Yeah.
But you knew there was some tragic thing that might have happened between getting off the island. And but you didn't know what it was, so it was fueled by that mystery, and you were trying to connect the dots. Well, our dots are going to be connected when we get to the adult story.
We already know. Yeah.
But well, let's talk about this story, though.
So as far as I think it's a very... Judging it on its own, especially from someone who doesn't know the source material, I think it's a really well done adaptation. Meaning, it feels like a movie. It doesn't feel like a book. When I'm watching this movie, there isn't a moment where I go, this feels like a bad book adaptation. You know, like,
that's like the best way I could probably think to describe this.
Because when you...
Well, good job.
Because when you watch... Okay, for instance, Harry Potter, you know, a lot of those later movies, especially where the book is like 800 pages, you feel the loss. And I don't know the Harry Potter books, but when I'm watching it, I feel like this is a truncated material missing a ton of shit. When I watch this movie, there's lots of Easter eggs and references that people have told me are lacking context for the fans of the book, and they get frustrated. But as a viewer... I'm not going, what does that mean? No. You know what I mean?
It doesn't leave you in the dust.
Exactly.
And I couldn't agree more with the Harry Potter thing. Everything feels like it goes from the machine in Harry Potter, where it's like, how do we fix something? Well, there's a thing. And I'm like, well, what is that? You know, this didn't feel like that.
Right.
It didn't feel like I was lost.
But we're so much of the stuff that comes out now is based on pre-existing IP. So I feel like it's a regular experience now where I'm watching something and I feel like something's missing. Like, for instance, the recent Netflix Death Note. I could feel the loss of some of the material that didn't make it in, even though I wasn't familiar with the source material. Yeah. What I'm saying is and I like that movie too.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'm saying is when I watch this movie, I don't feel the loss of any material.
Yeah. And I should throw in there too that Gary Dauberman actually got credit on this. He took that original True Detective draft and then did a rewrite.
Okay, so he polished it up.
He came on. And the reason I need to mention him was he was my manager at one point.
Holy shit, really? Jamie. Yeah.
So this is a weird connection. I mean, he was the assistant to my manager, but he was the guy who actually liked my quirky, weird horror stuff. He was a big Stephen King fan. He comes from Philly. He used to meet me up down the street here in White Marsh every now and then.
What?
He's a really nice guy. And it was early in his career when he first moved to LA and he wanted to be a writer. And he was writing on the side and he was an assistant at this. It was a woman named Catherine James who he was one of her assistants. And he very quickly started to write and get noticed after that. And I really haven't, not to say... my judgment about how much I like the script has anything to do with how much I know him, but he is a really good guy. He's a really good guy that I liked. And I haven't really talked to him since.
So this could be his dream job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm sure is what he was aiming for.
He always struck me as a very humble guy, but I absolutely bet it was one of his dream jobs. He's also worked on the Annabelle movies.
He's in the
James Wan world. Yeah. He's doing The Nun.
I think it's Wan, but
is it James Wan?
James Wan. Us and the names.
I
say Wan?
I know, we're terrible
James
with names.
What did I say? James Wan?
Wan. Yeah.
Okay.
Just Wan. Like
I could be wrong.
No, you're right.
I think it's
right.
Wan.
So, anyway, Gary Dauberman.
That's inspirational.
Even Dauberman's a weird name to say, but at least I knew him. I knew his pronunciation.
Sounds like he made it to the top of the ladder. He was climbing up.
Yeah.
Yeah. A good guy, too. Very nice guy.
The biggest horror movie of all time by the biggest horror writer of all time.
Yeah,
but as I say that, there is some discussion about what this movie is apparently, I didn't know until Jimmy introduced this and you introduced this to me, and I saw Jimmy on Twitter was yesterday.
Oh yeah, I want to. I want to know. People are so funny about their definition of a horror.
People
movie.
Are question. We're questioning if this counts as a horror movie,
which is insane.
I don't get that. But can you guys? Do you guys have any explanation of why that is being?
I don't have an insight as to why someone would think this isn't a horror movie.
What is it if it's not? Okay.
So maybe this is more from the writer perspective.
It's a drama with somebody in makeup.
There are some examples of of people, and I think this is the bulk of them. It's just, it didn't scare me. It's not a horror movie. That's a horrible
thing.
So, I didn't laugh. It's not a comedy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But I honestly think there's another factor, and it's this goes back to the Blake Snyder genre factor, because this is a very loose monster in the house.
True.
Okay. They're not trapped, in my opinion. They would probably be better off survival wise. Now, Georgie would never be found and stuff like that, to just go home and hide or something. Yeah. I mean, maybe not, because Georgie died and there's some other, but maybe only one of them would get plucked off or something like that. But they're not as trapped. I think this is
the
more
monster
of a,
does come to them, though.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
Is, it I, is coming rules. To them.
It does.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a quest movie. I mean, in some ways, it's almost aligned to Saving Private Ryan or something.
Yeah.
You know, there's a team that's going on a quest.
Or I'd even say Goonies.
Or it's Goonies.
It feels more like Goonies.
Or Monster Squad. Yeah.
But I mean, that was the time
things.
When it was written.
Stranger
that's
things.
Indicative of the stories that were being told at the time then it was crafted. You know, think
well, we're
about
also
it.
Talking about a story that's been displaced to a new time to fit with the time it's being made.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that.
Not but, much different time. It was 88.
The well, no, what I'm saying
place.
Is the story
oh,
takes place. The kids are in the 50s in the book.
That's right, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And I understand what you're saying.
Okay, yeah. I'm just saying that might change some with the stylistically.
I think so.
It changes
I think
a little.
So.
Yeah.
So I had, anyway, this is more of a writerly theory than it probably is. The fans are, I really honestly think it's just like, it wasn't scary.
It didn't scare me.
Yeah, nobody
said,
got pushed into a wood chipper.
Everybody said it was scary.
But it made me wonder that if your goal as a hero isn't necessarily survival, and is it a horror movie? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing for it, but that was something I noticed, that the plot of it is very similar to other movies that are not horror movies, but it does have these horrific elements.
Can I point to an older episode of ours?
Sure.
Poltergeist.
Yeah.
I don't feel like the exact plot of Poltergeist is survival.
No.
It's saving someone like this movie, but
I
the
agree.
Family's not like in the house dying.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to get, I'm just saying it's slightly similar.
I will
There's
argue
danger
on both of you guys' side that whether survival is imminent, you're still feeling primal fear,
yeah.
right?
No,
to
I'm
me,
with you, man. I'm not.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
This is
yeah,
definitely
yeah.
a horror movie.
No, no, no. I'm saying
I managed
examples,
a video store for 5 years. This
in
is in the
examples?
Horror section without question.
Oh yeah, no,
you know,
yeah.
yeah.
We're not arguing.
Yeah,
none of us
that's
are
arguing
on the
that.
Side
yeah.
that this isn't a horror movie. I mean, I just can't believe it because. Taken if the book didn't if there was no book and this just came into the movies as is, I think this would be like stack up next, like it felt like a great 90s monster movie, like it would stack up next to like the late Nightmare on Elm Street movies and Candyman, all of those things. I think that it would still be heralded without,
sit right next to Pumpkin
yeah, yeah,
Head.
No, it would.
Right,
people,
yeah, yeah.
yeah, it's a creature feature. It's like. True. It's a no-brainer, but I get what you're saying. It's the like, what is the goal?
Yeah, and yeah. I'm more
Do you
arguing
think
that
that's why they're arguing it though. The goal. I don't.
I there is
I'm not
a
giving
certain,
them much.
There
credit,
is a certain
but.
Feel that it's more of a quest to me. It's more. There's a whole genre that Hollywood talks about. The kids on bikes movies is kind of the genre.
Yeah.
And most of those have horror elements, but they tend not to be horror. Even Stranger Things, is that horror? Is it sci-fi? I'm not sure. It's debatable.
It's a mix.
I'm more arguing
I'd
that,
argue horror, but that'd be me.
Me too.
I'm more arguing that horror has nothing to do with the plot.
Yes.
That's more of what I'm saying. So I'm coming at it from the reverse angle.
So what
you're coming
defines,
at it from a writing aspect.
Yeah,
sure.
Writer,
I think most people
like,
come at it from a visceral aspect.
Yeah.
And I don't think horror is plot. I think the only way really to define horror is to say, are there elements in this that are gonna cause that are focused on causing people to have nightmares, you know?
Yeah.
Is its goal is a certain, and it's a balance, right? Because Raiders of the Lost Ark has horror movie moments.
Yeah.
It has melting faces and all this other stuff, but it's not a horror movie.
Right.
So where is the difference?
But
what
it's
did Twitter
overall,
tell you?
Its overall intent is different. The overall intent
That's
of
right.
the experience of Indiana Jones is action adventure based.
And not to debate this, but is the overall intent of this to scare?
Absolutely.
I think so.
Absolutely.
I absolutely would argue this
is
to create fear.
This is a movie
Whether
about fear.
Whether it's effective or not, we're not
this
arguing.
This is a movie
it's just,
about fear. And so
literally the plot is about fear, even though I know you're trying to ask it about plot.
Yeah, we're
but,
not arguing with
but
you.
The monster here damn literally it, feeds
you
off.
Guys are wrong.
That's I it. Like, last episode.
I really do like when we disagree, and it rarely happens.
I don't think we're disagreeing.
No, we're not. But
I'm more playing devil's advocate.
So
I put it in the art.
My definition, you know, because you asked this question, so like I more put it out to the crowd because I have a lot of people that I'm connected with who are like horror film people, and I just really wanted to hear what people say.
No, I was glad I read through your
thread. It is
your
a fucking loaded question for many people. For some, it's like no brainer.
I love the people that responded. They were just like, "When people die," and I was like,
yeah.
"Oh, okay."
Yeah. Like, no, it's for some people, it's really simple and cut and
war
dry.
War movies are horror movies,
or it has a lot of violence. And there are horror movies that have no violence.
Yeah,
from a writing standpoint, I think it's about intent. I think it's what is your intention with the work. With the story, what are you trying to do to the audience, you know, make them feel? And if your goal overall is to scare them, to make them feel primal fear by whatever you're throwing at the characters and the audience and the experience, then it's a horror.
And one thing I like to talk about with movies in general, I say every movie is a horror movie.
Yeah,
because almost every movie, there are some
Happy Gilmore.
But yeah, I think Happy Gilmore is definitely on there.
I haven't seen terrifying.
Adam Sandler. But every movie's goal is to kind of make you tense and then give you release,
tension
make
release.
You tense, give you release.
Yeah. And you've talked about this a lot.
We talked about with Solo how
with
every
jokes.
Action scene was like a
comedy. Is
the
that
comedy
right?
pro con, good bad.
Right.
And that horror is just the tension that it gives you is a different kind of tension. It's more primal. It's more more intense. Yeah. It's trying to make you look away and really unsettle you.
Yeah.
Whereas the other kind might play it a little safer. But every movie, in my opinion, is really a horror movie to a
when
certain
it comes
extent.
Down to it. That's fascinating.
That's the problem, I think, with this definition is they all share DNA. But what does it matter to writers? I actually think it doesn't really matter to writers.
It's what you make it,
it's
like
what
my friend
you make
said.
It.
Can I also posit something, too? I think in the post-streaming world, I think genre kind of doesn't matter anymore. I don't even know why people are arguing. It's like, like when the video store
the
days,
who are
we grew up with
are
it.
Old.
Yeah, I feel like we grew up with genre. Video stores are my life, but now it's like
my nephew
I don't
doesn't
look at,
give a shit.
I don't look at my menus on my streaming services like, well, let me look at the comedy section. I don't even do that anymore.
I guarantee you my 12-year-old nephew who loves all sorts of movies, if I talk genre with him, he'd have zero opinion, and when he's 18 he's gonna have zero opinion.
I have to imagine the people that are arguing this are people that are horror guys.
Yes.
Okay. I would imagine, and they're like, that's
but
not,
that is the core it audience that,
that's
so.
Not part of our club. Whereas I don't know, it might be the core audience in some ways, but this one has a broader
the
mass
appeal.
It has this
well,
mass
let's
appeal.
Talk about that.
Well, let's talk about that. But I feel like what Jamie said is right. Like, this is whenever you have a horror movie that's immensely popular, like Quiet Place or what have you, there always seems to be the more elite that are like, well, that's not actually a horror movie. You know what I'm saying?
I think this is a great topic. So Jamie posed the question, blockbuster horror versus indie horror, is there a difference? So what do you think?
I definitely think there's a difference. I don't know what it is.
You don't know what it is?
No, I have thoughts.
You do.
I have thoughts. But what do you think?
Well,
I think it's broad versus specific.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, it's pretty simple, but like a lot of the movies that become big famous horror movies, they didn't start out broad. They like picked up kind of word of mouth and traction, like a Get Out and a Quiet Place.
Paranormal Activity. Yeah. The Blair Witch Project.
And
Jaws.
And they're more... Jaws, I think, is more like.
I know.
Yeah. I wrote
Jaws
down what I feel
movie.
Like. So what?
People
what
say
I,
that.
Let's
though.
Fight.
Oh shit! Is Jaws a horror movie? Oh my god! Who are these people?
You okay?
Yeah. It just stresses me out so much. I don't know why it stresses me out, but like the idea that somebody would sit home, it's elevated horror. I hate these subject, these post-horror.
I'm just saying, maybe
horror genre
getting
definition.
Away from the genre argument in general might be better for everybody.
Yeah, agreed.
I think the differences between indie film, indie horror, and blockbuster horror or mainstream horror, whatever we want to call it. I think they're the same as the difference between indie films and mainstream films.
Yeah.
You take a movie like Hereditary, which was a big popular, well, it wasn't a big popular film, but it made some waves in its own indie space.
Yeah.
And it doesn't worry about some of the things that mainstream horror worries about. It doesn't worry about connecting the dots.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't worry about all the different screenwriting closed systemness of it. In fact, I think it uses that as a strength. It actually doesn't pay off everything because it feels a little more real, or things come out of left field more, and it's a different experience.
Yeah.
Whereas I think it, for all its horrorness, is a comfortable experience. Definitely. We get laughs there.
Oh yeah.
We might cry there. We get that full range of emotions that we get from almost a Pixar film.
Yeah.
All in a mainstream.
It's horror. Crafted.
As you said, Jimmy, it feels comfortable in that it reminded me of watching movies when I was a kid.
Yep. 90s.
Right.
It felt like a 90s monster.
And that,
movie.
I couldn't agree
in
more.
In the best
like,
way possible.
When I saw Hereditary 3 times. I liked it. I know we've all argued about it. But that doesn't make me think of... There's no nostalgia when I watch Reddit. You know what I mean? There's no, there's nothing there because it's not connecting to anything before it. Whereas this movie, I was like, everything.
But from a writing standpoint, there are...
That's what
I'm
saying.
You hit the
nail
on the head. There's two different designs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you're looking for mass appeal, you want to make it as digestible as possible. Right, and as traditional,
it's a four quadrant horror movie.
Yes, and this checks that box. It's digestible. It is. Everything is tied up in a bow. You know, it feels like your traditional Hollywood movie.
This movie took clowns, and you know, like I think we haven't had a clown horror movie in a long time. And
Night Watchman.
I think
The Night Watchman, co-written by Jamie Nash, right?
Chris and I almost made one.
Okay, well, outside of what you guys have done,
Eli Roth's clown,
right? This had the promise of that potential when it was announced, and I think it actually delivered on the clown horror that we haven't
pretty
had.
Much.
It fed into that.
Yeah.
Like Jaws feeds into the fear of swimming.
Yeah, chlorophobia.
It hit chlorophobia really well.
It delivered on the promise of the premise plenty.
A real fear that really
plenty
exists. And the movie delivered in spades. Yeah. Just at the right moment.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, can't argue that.
Yeah, we talked way more about genre than I was expecting.
Yeah, we haven't talked. Let's talk about structure a little bit. Because we've talked about the theory behind the movie way more.
Did you want to talk on the different types of horror that are used in this movie? You know, the terror,
dread.
Stephen King.
I think with this movie, and a little bit the structure too, one thing we noticed we were talking about before we went on air was that this is another movie with a prologue kind of structure in some ways. I mean, this one, it's a shorter prologue, but you could almost see a version of this movie where you cut that whole scene and you don't see Pennywise in the beginning. So he's more revealed throughout.
Yeah, you could start with meeting Bill and Georgie's already missing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's in the script because it's so iconic? The prologue.
It's a great scene.
Well,
it's just a great
sequence.
But that is the iconic part of the book and the other version too.
It would be hard not.
Can you imagine the movie without it? No.
It's too iconic. Yeah.
It's the money scene.
This version of it is so good.
Yes.
Yeah. No. So, it is.
Like my favorite. I don't think the movie ever gets. It's got the Blade syndrome. Like Blade 1, the best scene in the movie is the opening scene, and it's never as cool. I don't think the
whatever
movie,
Blade rules, man.
I love all the Blades except for 3. I don't think the movie ever gets as good as the opening sequence for me, even though I love this movie. Yeah, so I can't imagine it without
it. I don't agree with that. But
The New Kids on the Block jokes. Is that what it was? I know. That was the best
part. I mean, my favorite part in the movie is actually the baseball
Please,
bat.
Please, girl, don't go.
When he pulls the baseball bat and there's that moment where he's like, I guess I'm going to have to kill this fucking clown.
That's great.
That's my favorite part of the movie.
Great.
Yeah.
So
Richie!
Speaking of that prologue, though, it kind of shows you, once you show the clown, you kind of kill. There's not as much mystery in it.
Right.
You know, we know what the villain is.
Nothing's as scary as what you imagine.
He shows his stuff right away. It's not Jaws where it's under the water and kind of hidden. No, it's similar. It's similar to the opening scene of Jaws.
Yeah.
But this movie delivers on Pennywise over and over and over. And I think that might be where it feels a little different than the book. And again, I read the book as a 10-year-old.
Gotcha.
But the book filled me with dread. And this movie doesn't have as much dread because it keeps showing me stuff.
Gotcha.
And I don't have a problem with that. It's just a different feel.
I think it would. I think it would have been almost frustrating with the marketing versus what this movie did within the content. You know what I mean? Like, I want to see the clown, I think.
I think to fill this whole story and have that level of dread, you have to turn it into a television series.
Yeah.
I think it would have to be an 8-episode television series where you're given little pieces and, you know, it's more dramatic.
I like we're disagreeing on something. Mm-hmm. I feel like this movie is fucking loaded with dread. Even though you do see the terror, would you define Pennywise as terror?
Yeah.
The terror.
Yeah,
okay.
He's the terror.
So, but the dread is that he can do anything. You don't know which way he's coming from. You know that he's there, but not what he's doing.
So one thing I noticed that I didn't notice. The first time through upon rewatching and deconstructing this, he only shows up. I mean, we know it's well known because of the source material, and a lot of this might be credit to Stephen King and not the writer, you know, the screenwriters. But he only shows up when someone is experiencing their specific personal fear.
Right.
So each character, when they're experiencing their moments, like Rich, what the hell is his name? The kid that is scared of disease.
Oh, yeah.
When he takes out his pills,
Mike,
the fucking leper shows up. You know, it's only when he takes out his pills and he's experiencing. Yeah, yeah. So I think that it sets
a bit of a source material.
And I think the movie sets like strict rules for when Pennywise will appear. You know what I mean?
Well, and while that is true, there are a lot of Pennywise appearances. So that's what I'm saying. While there is dread, there's no doubt dread used. Every time Pennywise shows up, it releases the dread.
Yeah, you're saying the buildup is gone.
There's not as much buildup. Yeah. Just because there can't be. I'm not suggesting that's a problem. It's just a different type of
Do you think that's to please this modern audience?
I honestly just think it was needed to tell the story.
Okay.
You know, I think it's the type of story. And again, I think that might be a little bit where the, is this a horror movie thing comes in?
Yeah.
Because it's so present that the monster's there. We know what it is. Yeah. It's not as much of a
mystery. Like skip to Freddy 5.
Yeah.
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 And instead of Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy is rarely seen.
It was like if Freddy was already established and having fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It skipped to Freddy 5.
Which is my preferred Freddy.
Mine too.
I actually prefer when he was having fun.
Yeah, and that's true. If you want to make Pennywise more of a character, you have to show him and have him having fun with his kills. Nothing kills
tasty,
so much.
Tasty, beautiful fear.
But it's a good point because if you watch the first Nightmare, Freddy's not as much of a character.
No.
To me, the first one is much creepier, scarier.
Yeah,
nightmare inducing. The other ones are huge fun. I love them. I mean,
But this one's was not about that. They were trying to scare the shit out of you with the clown.
That's right.
Do you think a lot of there's a lot of jump scares in this movie?
There's
23. Which I think a lot of the horror fans might be also objecting to that when it comes to the backlash on it. But do you think those are in the script? Or is that
they are.
Some of them seem like they're editing to
some
me.
Some of them are
they're editing and yeah.
Yeah. I think they are, though. I would imagine they are. What do you think, Jamie?
I've read the script and I can't really remember. Like a lot of times writers will use tricks like they'll underline them and stuff like that, or they'll put them in bold.
Yeah.
And they'll
loud sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a while I remember where I would send a script out, a horror script, and Ghost House Pictures or something would have a rule that you had to have a scare every five. And I'm not blaming
the pacing
Ghost House
of the jumps,
but they literally would count them.
Yeah.
And nowadays I feel it's more feel. It's like this doesn't have enough scares.
It's a whammy count.
Yeah.
It's yeah. A whammy count. You need this a whammy every. Yeah.
So that's a Joel Silver thing where a whammo, or I think he had a whammo board or something.
I use the whammy, and when I'm making doing horror, I just use a red marker for blood. You know, like I do the I write it on the page. If I'm flipping through and I'm missing red for two or three pages, it's
Joel Silver's used to chart action sequences across scripts, and it was called a whammy board or whammo board or whatever he called it. And he was like, this page needs a whammo.
And it's based on press your luck, you know.
Yeah.
No whammies, no whammies.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's a press your luck reference.
Savage Steve Holland.
So you're saying you think that these are probably
these
in
are
there. They're
paced
written into
whammies.
The fabric.
I would say these are paced horror whammies.
I love
whammies.
That you counted them. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And it's well, I don't know. I didn't know that you would do that. That's
it's
awesome.
It's certainly a thing. I had
Dude, I go overboard with this podcast.
I had a chart of different movies and how many jump scares they had. You yeah. probably saw this chart at some point. It was going around the internet. And surprisingly, there weren't that many more jump scares now than there were before and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, what you learn is when you really take the time to study your favorite movies, they all have 20,
yeah.
30.
Yeah.
You know, even the ones where you imagine them as just dread filled, mm-hmm. they still have 20 or 30. Like, I think Scream has
It just
over
depends
30.
On their if they're earned or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Cheap jump scares. Cheap. There are jump scares that are earned. Yeah. So, yeah.
A good one, though.
Yeah.
We all love a good one that gets us.
We all love the one where they just throw the cat at us randomly.
Right.
That's the one we want.
I could do without all cat jump scares. Like, yeah.
Find the cliche, throw it away.
What did you've got in here? The Stephen King quote on types of horror. I feel like we.
Well, yeah, we kind of covered
about,
that.
Did we cover that? Yeah, we covered it.
We covered it another. So the Stephen King quote. Not. I don't. Unfortunately, I didn't.
You
have
made.
Written,
you
so.
Made it into four, and I like your four better.
Okay. I don't remember the four, but it was basically Stephen King says something along. I'll try to horrify you. I'll try to. And he lists like three things. And if that doesn't work, I'll gross you out.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
not proud. And really, they're the types of horror we have. We have the dread, mm-hmm. we have the suspense, which I think we mm-hmm. may have added.
Yeah.
The terror, which is the Pennywise jumping out at you.
The moment.
The attacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what I'm saying. This movie has a
the
lot of...
The undeniable fear that's in your face.
Yeah. This movie delivers on that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Whereas some movies don't. Some movies keep that whole thing off to Act 3, and then Pennywise jumps out in Act 3 or something. Or maybe once you'll come out.
This almost had scene one deliver.
Scene one.
Oh, yeah.
And scene one, scene three, scene five, scene seven. I mean, he was
coming.
Him as a character is delivering on that just by being on screen almost, right? Yeah.
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 And so just one thing I noted, and because a lot of writers ignore this stuff, they do a good job of making death like ever present, even when there's moments of levity and stuff. Like, even the moments of levity sometimes are with lines talking about death. Like, Bill says, "I'd come with you if I weren't dying." You know, he's coughing.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Georgie says, "Bill's gonna kill me." Bill's gonna kill me. And you like my Georgie?
Yeah.
And then Richie, when he meets Ben, dude just got stabbed, and he says, "I'm glad I met you before you died." Like, they're constantly throwing in these things that just plant the seed of death still in your head. And that's in the writing, mm-hmm. definitely. That's intentional. It's like, even though Pennywise is nowhere near and the scene is not calling for Pennywise to be you to be scared of Pennywise, it plants that seed back in your head that you should be. Yeah. And well, I just thought that was really well handled.
With the So, like, that really goes down with the interplay of the characters and the fact that this is kind of a team movie, right?
Yeah.
It really is. No, it does.
I mean, would you agree too many?
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing, you know, it feels like there are so many characters. No, you know, I want to talk about the ensemble, the group. How to break
characters.
That's
why I brought it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it feels like if you were constructing this just by yourself without adapting a book, a classic book that everybody wants to see.
Three kids.
It would be three kids, four
three
kids.
That's
Look at
all
Stranger
you
Things.
That's all you need.
How many Stranger
four.
Things? Four, I think, was the team.
Yeah.
Right now, I think a couple of the kids get marginalized and have nothing to do.
Oh,
you could,
yeah.
What I would do in that situation, if this were my original screenplay, I would combine
Jamie
these
Nash
characters.
Is it.
Jamie Nash is it.
It would be good.
I'd combine those characters into four characters. You know, you could take two of them and smush them together.
And that's often, and like you said, if you were from a teaching standpoint, if your character has nothing to do, then they don't belong there.
Right.
And so how you make that work is you combine them with somebody. It's like your favorite things about this character you really want to explore things with. How can I keep that character, but like, give them something to do, and you mix them with another one.
Exactly. That's the typical you
but
combine.
There's a reverence for the source material here. That
yes,
probably
exactly.
Keeps them
not
there.
Only
yeah.
that, not only is there a reverence, it's 1,000 pages in the source material. So you have a lot of room to explore these characters, but also the way it's told in those two, you know, flashback concurrent structure, Spoiler alert, but they may kill off some of those characters a little quicker than others. So they narrowed
their Star Trek red shirts.
Yeah, they narrowed the team, and you know that. So these characters are just people from their past, like, you know, or this one or whatever.
Remember that guy who had this issue?
Yeah, so it's a different structure. Yeah. It's an entirely different structure. But if I was setting out to do this, and look, Stranger Things, I think there's a reason they have four. Yeah. Three is like a magic number because you can kind of get a balance.
Yeah.
That would be my, I would go with three.
And it's way more manageable from a writing standpoint, too. I mean, they went to exhaustive lengths.
If we look at
it was a comedy, I'd throw in more characters.
Look at the,
but a horror movie.
Well, look at the Kids on Bikes movies. We have E.T., that's three characters.
Goonies is a lot.
Goonies kind of goes against
Goonies has the big number. Monster Squad, what's that, three?
Four.
Oh, no, that's like, four or five.
Four.
Really?
Well, if you count the little girl. And then at the end,
and
there's like the older,
moments,
attractive
I count her.
Virgin.
Oh, yeah.
The non-virgin girl. Yeah. It depends what you count as. Who
Explorers
counts,
is three.
Three.
Stand By Me is four.
Four. Yeah. It's just Stephen King. It's pretty rare when you get these larger numbers.
Yeah.
I don't feel like this is too large, though. This is, you know, and the movie obviously cares about all the characters.
Oh, yeah.
It's the runtime that might not give a few of them what their due is.
It does a great job with them. I never really felt like, why is this kid in it? But at the same time, if I was writing this myself, it would be different. Yeah.
How is the Jewish kid Stan different in the book than he is in the movie? You don't even remember?
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
I'm fat as a person who doesn't know the source material. His character in particular, I'm very interested to see what they do with him as an adult, because he's the one character who doesn't face his fears. In fact, he succumbs to them.
Yeah.
But what's even stranger is, and I say stranger because everything, all the other characters, the work is meticulous with pointing out a specific childhood trauma, right? With him, I was trying to figure out what it is that he's afraid of. And it's basically, there's a painting in the synagogue that's like keeping him from being able to study the Torah. And it's just a painting. It's not like something, a childhood trauma.
I think if the movie had more time, it would be his actual fear of the synagogue itself.
Becoming a man. He says his first line in the movie is, I got to read the Torah so I can become a man. That's like the first thing out of
the movie
mouth.
Just doesn't have time to give atmosphere to his fear.
So the previous draft of the script, the immediately previous draft had that scene instead of the scene with the painting.
Yeah.
It was like a woman wanting to have sex with him. It almost reminded me of The Shining.
Being a man.
And that was his fear. And so the previous draft, I remember that was a big difference.
I think that would have worked.
Seems like they made a broad decision on that one.
Yeah, I think exactly.
They wanted to keep it too much like Bev. No, dude, I think they just want
to
keep all sexuality out of it.
Yeah, they did as much as they could. Yeah. Just like they toned down the racism, even though it's there.
It's there in the Shining a little bit.
Okay.
In the bathtub.
That would have been good. So that's what I was looking for, just because I was basing it on
this
material.
That's not that movie, though.
Basing it on the material. Well, it's about sexual awakening is a big undertone in this movie. Definitely.
I think
they do everything they can to suppress it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's part of what this movie
is.
It's sanitized.
Just like the racism.
If Kubrick made this movie, I couldn't even imagine.
Yeah.
The whole thing would be sex.
Yeah.
Everybody else has a clear through line. All the characters in the movie. And this, and Stan doesn't. It's like, what is his fears? It's like this weird painting because Andy, the guy, was like, I'll get the person from Mama to be in this. It feels like a decision from Andy.
Yeah.
To get that creepy actor they have. They're Doug Jones in there.
Well, let's talk about their arcs. We got him covered, but let's talk about some of their other arcs.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I think you can track this movie basically by their arcs really, definitely.
It's character driven
for sure. And the team basically has the same arc in some ways. It's kind of like almost a team arc to an extent. They start out, I mean, I think the movie's theme, if we wanted to hit the
theme, let's hit them.
It kind of comes out right there in that Mike scene with the when they're putting the bolt in the head of the sheep. I can't remember exactly what he said. Did you write it down?
Of course I wrote it down.
There's no way, Jamie.
Because it is like the thematics. It's not clean.
He should have just looked at the camera and just said,
yeah,
it, right?
He says, he says there are only two places you can be in this world. Out here like us, which is the killers, or in there like them, which is lambs for the slaughter.
And really the movie is, in my opinion, thematically, it's about standing up to bullies or standing up for yourself. Whether the bully is your abusing father.
Yeah.
Or you're, you know, if it's a clown, Pennywise, or an actual bully who's chasing you around.
Facing your fears.
It's kind of standing up to
them. You're El Guapo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's standing up to them and fighting for yourself.
Right.
That's kind of what it's about.
It's as simple as that. And on
top of that, I'd say that they find that through being together.
Yeah.
They find the courage to do that.
Yeah. A lot of the lines hint that you could argue, this is later because we're going to touch on what the lesson is, but there's like a lot of intention in the writing to state that teamwork and friendship is just as important as facing your fears. Like they say, the only reason that we survived is because we fought them together.
Yeah.
You know, and then the very last line of the movie, which would lead you to think that this is what they wanted you to leave the movie with, is she says, I never felt like I was a loser when I was with you guys.
Right.
That's the last line of the movie.
So the movie's about unity.
Yeah.
Completely.
Exactly. Yeah. As far as crafting, one thing we didn't talk about, crafting the team and choosing your characters from a writing standpoint, so you got this theme, right?
Yeah. So, there are a lot of ways to come up with your team, especially if you're just starting to write your script and you're figuring out who the characters are, maybe you have a plot. But one of the ways some people do it, and I've done it once or twice myself, is by kind of fitting each of the characters into archetypes to see like what roles they fit in your story. And if you looked at like the hero's journey, they'd have these crazy names like the trickster or the herald.
Yeah, the fool. Like,
you know, what does that mean exactly? Yeah. Or stuff. So one book I like to reference for this, and it's kind of a very Save the Cat written type book, and it's probably my favorite post Save the Cat book. But it's called My Story Can Beat Up Your Story by Jeffrey Allen Schechter, I guess.
Names again.
Names.
This episode is
boy,
a mess.
What I wouldn't
names.
Get for Jeffrey Allen Jones.
Yeah, right. Right.
So he has a whole chapter on various characters, and it's really archetypical characters. So I'll read you the types of characters he has, and we can talk a little bit about. Let me define them super quick. So he, if you want to look at that.
Oh yeah.
If he. I'm trying to find my definition.
I'm familiar with the book, so I was glad that you brought it up. I actually, I really like that book.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And
it's very practical, much like Save the Cat. So his heroes, first of all, he has a hero and a villain. And I think in this case, Bill's the hero.
The hero, yeah.
Pennywise is the villain. Maybe also the bully. What's the bully?
Henry.
Name? Henry. I think you could put him in bully category.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's
just a bit.
He's the fear of many of the characters.
I should look the actual definitions up because I didn't have them written. But there's a protector character, and the protector is the character who is the keeper of the hero's moral compass. Who would you think? I can tell you who I have.
Man.
Well, I agree with you. I saw that you said Bev.
I
agree.
Bev would be my answer.
I think Bev really never challenges. She is almost the muse and the leader and the inspiration.
She's the strongest.
She's the spirit.
She's the strongest of the kids.
And there's a scene.
Without a doubt.
Easily, and her personal story is.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the worst. Easily.
Well,
this movie, it is the worst of all of them.
So, and by the way, I should say, there are six characters here. So, and I'll just read them super quick. The protector, the deflector, the believer, the doubter, the thinker, and the feeler. And then on top of that, you have the hero and the villain.
Yeah.
Richie's the doubter.
These are very archetypal characters.
Right?
When you say it like that.
Yeah. Richie's definitely. The one thing I'd say in this story is some of these characters, when you get to the doubter, the thinker, and the feeler, some of them mix and match.
Yeah. Richie's both the doubter and the feeler.
Richie also doesn't get visited by Pennywise.
Yes, he does later.
Later on.
I broke it down.
Yeah. In the early part of the story. He's part of the team before he's visited.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
So and just to skip, the feeler is the character who, though an ally of the hero, intuitively, I'm reading for the book, intuitively shoots first and asks questions later. And it's usually like Han Solo mm-hmm. or something like that.
So Richie is like that.
And I think Richie's a little like that at times.
Yeah. He's not thinking about the shit that he's saying.
Exactly.
Not at all. However, well, he's not thinking at all.
He also, I feel like he doesn't get visited early on because he's not a character of depth. Like his actual character.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the story doesn't he's have not a place thinking for, yeah. on levels where he's that afraid of anything because he's never there mentally, you know?
Yeah. And the thinker character is usually somebody that overthinks it. You know, they're kind of like, well, I'm not sure, maybe. And I think the Mike character, that's the
is
one
that
with
his
the
name?
Is that his name?
Eddie.
I'm sorry. Why am I calling him
Eddie
Mike?
Is the
Mike's
one.
Mike's the African American.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Eddie is the one. I think Eddie is the one that's always
he's the thinker.
Through. Like,
definitely,
maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe, you know, he's kind
of
that character.
Although
his
all
fear,
of his, all,
his
all
fear
of
almost
his,
defines
his,
that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in all of the moments where he's like, maybe we shouldn't do that, is about his own fear of getting sick.
Right.
Like that.
Right,
it has nothing to do with like Pennywise. It's like this gray water. I'm gonna get listeria.
Right.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
And then I think the doubter. I think they all kind of mix in. Like a lot of them have doubters.
Yeah.
Trademarks. I put Stan here, but I think Eddie doubts at times.
Yeah.
And they all kind of doubt, and they all has lost
me. Who did you say Mike was again? Which archetype?
Mike. I don't think Mike fits in.
I don't think Mike fits in.
I think Mike's
this,
left
this is
out.
Where the six kind of come into play. We never really get a taste of him.
Even though Mike is Mike's story is very clear cut.
Well,
he has the least
amount
of beats.
Number one, he has the theme is stated right to him.
To him. And I think that was intentional because they were like, we got to find something.
His fear story is also very well defined.
Yeah, definitely.
The only moment of his psychology I really feel is when he says, you know, I am an outsider or something. He has that kind of thing, but I'm not even sure.
If I had a criticism of this movie, it would be how his story is handled.
Yeah, because
I think they actually shouldn't have cut out like the racism inherent in the source material and stuff, because it plays there and it's like just say it.
Just say it.
Don't it's so obvious. Like just put it in this, just write that. Yeah. It's obvious.
I mean, that's his fear is racism.
Right. Yeah. Like,
and then, but the story glosses over. He's got an issue. He's got to overcome the guilt of believing he's responsible for his parents, but it's so glossed over. There's like two lines and two visual moments about it. Like,
And it could have been a better arc, because him choosing not to be slaughtered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Him choosing not to be the ones that are slaughtered is like big, you know?
Yeah.
He's the one that brings the weapon.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely. I think his is very clear cut, though. It's one of the easiest to track in the movie, but that's because he is so thin.
Yeah,
you know, it starts out with Henry beating him, and then him not fighting back, and then the second time it's even worse. Like, well, it starts out with him hiding from Henry and them, and then they chase him down with the car and just flick the cigarette at him, and then it escalates until the story is like begging him to fight back, you know, like more so than any of the other characters. Like, he's literally the one character who gets beat up like three times in the movie.
Also, the story gives him a clear-cut way to just leave the story.
Yeah,
he could easily just go
yep
and not be a part of this, but he decides to keep going.
That's why I put him down in this. There's two we haven't talked about. The believer, the character believes and trusts in the hero just as the hero is. But I put two believers. I put Ben and Mike.
Ben is.
Because Ben really is that believer.
Yes.
He just believes in the hero. He never really has a doubt. In fact, he's giving him information to feed his belief.
Ben's character is interesting because I don't think the movie gives him, of all the characters, a clear-cut fear. Like, Henry, he fears Henry, right?
Yeah.
But, like, those moments are, like, few and far between, and it's more about him.
It doesn't even feel like it's fear. He just runs across
right.
him.
Right, well, he gets stabbed. It's like, who's not going to be scared of some dude who just stabbed you?
Right.
like,
when it comes to the rock scene, like, he's ready to fight, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
they all
are. They're kind of inspired when they start throwing these rocks.
Yeah, with the fact that he's, like, he's into Bev, he's almost fearless in a way. Like, but once he decides something, he does it.
But I think his story is about, like fulfilling a need. Which is like companionship, and they go overboard with that. Like, he's the new kid on the block who likes new kids on the block, and then he's got a blank yearbook.
He comes to a town and figures everything else about it.
Yeah, because
he has
alone.
Nobody
in there. He's sitting
he
in the library, and she's like, "Where are your friends? Like, a boy should be playing with his friends in the summer. You don't have any friends." And he goes, "Can I have the book now?"
Right. Yeah. And then the last character is the deflector, the character who tries to pull the hero off the path with a different moral compass. Now,
that could be Richie a little bit.
In my opinion, though, this is the parents. That's what I think it is.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's any of the
kids. Who are being manipulated, though. They don't really have characters because they're almost manipulated the entire time.
You know, is trying to keep her kids safe. Bill's father is trying to say, forget about that.
All the parents are bullies.
So I think it's except Mike's
father's definitely not a bully, and he's right about everything.
His parents are dead, so that's
his guardian. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
So anyway, they're my takes, but these things are just you know, not every script has these, not anybody uses these necessarily.
Yeah.
But they can be a tool to help you. I bet most people don't even consider that stuff.
Yeah. It's a great tool.
I think it's especially great when you have a lot of characters, because what can happen is if you're not considering these jobs, and that's how he describes them. These are just jobs your character can have. Then characters just start saying the same thing, or they're on the same side of the argument. Yeah. This is just a way to psychologically put yourself in their shoes and try to figure out what they might say in a scene. And it really comes into play at like a scene when they are walking into the well house. And they're all kind of having a debate about it, and they can each express.
You don't want them all to go, let's do this shit.
You need contrast and conflict.
If I could make Jimmy smile for a second, I think if you didn't follow these archetypes at all, you get yourself a Rogue One. You do. You get yourself a Rogue One where they're all just kind of like blandly on the same page. And it's like,
no arguments, no conflict. I always try to. I mean, I think this movie does a great job. It knows what, from a construction size, and this is like Stephen King, but also the writers of this version, they've got the theme, which is facing your fears. And they're like, okay, each of these characters, how can we explore that theme? And it's all, their mini stories are built around that theme, and the decisions behind the moments you're going to put these characters are in are all still based around that theme. But it comes from the construction of deciding, okay, Bev's going to do this. It's all based on like picking out that theme, you know.
It's picking out that theme and then giving your character, positioning your characters around that theme.
Yeah.
That's really the key to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to be on the strong side? Who's going to be on the weak side? Right. How are you going to flip the script on them? Yeah.
Yeah. And in some ways, I've heard it described as your thesis. You know, that's your theme is your thesis. And this is almost like different positions of debate.
Different debates.
So when you come up with your theme, think of all the positions of debate and then try to find characters
who can be that voice.
That would embody those voices. Yeah. And that's how you get conflict. That's how you get depth. Yeah. It's all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this movie does a great job. It's all very clear, except for, in my opinion, Stan is, like I said, I'm very confused about what his viewpoint is.
It doesn't hurt the movie, but I agree with you.
I'm just saying I'm fascinated by the fact that everybody else is so clear.
Yeah, honestly,
I feel like a runtime, like additional 10 minutes, would have fixed it. That's all.
It's probably one line of dialogue.
It's two or three tweaks away.
Or it's also, again, if it was our own script, it's probably just cut him. Cut him out.
Yeah, he doesn't need to be there.
What's the name of the kid who's hypochondriac?
Eddie.
I feel like that's who I would smush together. Because the way Eddie plays out seems very similar to...
Overbearing mother who wants you to read the Torah.
You're right.
You just add that in. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So we just fixed Stephen King's problem.
He's got
1,100... Like you said, he's got 1,100 pages. These have two... They have 2 hours.
I don't feel like the source material was written as a movie in any way. From what I remember, that is a different type of writing altogether. Yeah. And we talked about what's the lesson?
We touched on it.
You printed out all these papers, Jimmy.
No, so we've talked about the moral premise. I thought it was a good way to bring up the moral premise for anybody who hasn't listened to all of these.
Yeah.
We talked about the moral premise in our early episodes, but we haven't touched on it again.
The book.
Yeah. What's the moral premise, Jamie?
Stanley Williams.
There you go.
It's a good book. I've read it since we started doing this podcast. So
yeah,
I bought it and read it.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good. It's really good.
And I'm on the same page with Jamie in that you can bring out ideas, tools. Yeah. Oh, Jamie's got it in his hand. See, Jamie likes it so much, he's got it with him.
Stanley D. Williams.
Yeah. So, I always have it readily available too to help my clients, because it's a really good reference to kind of help people hone in on what they're trying to say. Which this movie also does a great job of like, maybe they came up with stuff and then the theme came afterwards, you know, sure. Even though we said all the characters are based around the theme, you know, it could.
I feel like it comes afterwards in this one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's already, it's already the book. The DNA's already, yeah, there. It's already there. They just got to build it.
But, but so the moral premise is essentially vice, a specific moral vice leads to the main characters or the set of characters' failure. But a virtue, like the main controlling virtue, leads to the character's success. So in this movie, I thought it was, it could be one of two things, like we talked about. Fear and self-doubt leads to vulnerability and death, which is like essentially the whole movie is about that. But courage leads to empowerment and survival, which is the success of the movie. They're empowered.
You can just say one of the others.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. Both of those, yeah, things are inherent to, yeah, to this success at the end of the movie. Everybody is empowered and they're alive. You know, like that's what you look for. Like, what did the characters get by the end of the movie? And that's their success. Or
the only thing you have to fear is fear itself.
Or I said, like I said, the movie says we were all together when we heard it. That's why we're still alive. The movie makes lots of effort to say, like, friendship is what made us survive, you know, not just facing fear. So I would say isolation leads to vulnerability, mm-hmm, and death, mm-hmm, but cooperation, right, and teamwork leads to empowerment and survival.
Mm-hmm. A very common theme in a lot of movies.
Yeah, and a lot of kid movies.
A lot of kid movies.
I wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel on that.
Yeah.
No, and it doesn't
have to. Shouldn't have to,
Themes are usually truths everybody agrees with.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not trying to be divisive in the audience.
I think this one's pretty easy to read, and I liked that. You know, it's very a little on the nose, some people would say, but it worked.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think so. My lesson learned, just big picture, is every movie's a horror movie. You can learn a lot from horror movies. Every movie's a horror movie, and really any movie can be a horror movie if you give it the right coat of paint. Because it's not necessarily plot driven. It's not, you know, it's just, if you can deliver the thrills and the scares, almost any movie could be a horror movie if you give it the right kind of dark paint. So
I like that.
Paint darkly.
What's your lesson learned from this episode?
From this episode? Yeah. Well, I don't even know if it came from doing this episode, but my lesson learned from the movie is just, not an adaptation that isn't a slave to the source can be great.
Yeah.
When I walked out of this movie, that's kind of how I felt. I was like, they did it, because I doubted it the whole time. I just expected a mess.
That's how I felt about Twilight. It was just, no.
He's wearing a Twilight shirt, if you didn't know, right now. I think he's team Ed, or whatever.
I think my other lesson learned is, if you have a name I can't pronounce, your chances of success are going way up.
Change your name.
Yep.
Yeah, Nash is too easy. Nash is too easy. Well, we have anything else to say on Stephen King's It?
No.
Andy Muschietti's and Carrie Fukunaga? Terry Fukunaga?
I'm not going to help you.
Dude, I apologize. They're never going to hear this, but I feel
Jamie's
bad.
Jamie's old manager.
Sort of.
Who has a pronounceable name.
Pronounceable name. Though, some people might get stuck on it. Gary Dauberman. Look for him. Yeah. He's the hottest thing in horror right now. Yeah. Horror screenwriting.
Is he? Awesome. What is he doing now?
He is doing.
He said The Nun.
The Nun. James Wan. He's also doing. What's the kids show? Something After Dark. Things to Fear. He's doing that one.
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Are You Afraid of the Dark? That's the adaptation.
Yeah. He's writing that.
That's awesome.
That sounds like he's living the dream, man.
He's got all the jobs I want to have.
So you secretly hate him, right?
I secretly hate him, but no, he's too good of a guy. I really do. He's a good guy.
So the lesson we all learned is that sometimes the good guys win.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's what we learned.
Yeah, if you keep working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't give up the faith.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right, thanks for listening.
Stephen King's It. All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.